The topic for this evening is black and white frustration, the question of whether things have become better or worse in the relationship between blacks or whites. Once again, I take a chance to say something about the in case some folks are here who haven't been here before. It's that time when we don't drag in experts to make big presentations to us, but we try to stimulate conversation back and forth. That means that people share and no end product comes out, that we all take a vote or get consensus at the end, but we believe that in the sharing of same points of view or maybe different points of view, some good would be done for all of us. So therefore, it's okay to disagree, to take differing points of view. It's okay to build on what somebody else has said. We even ask questions about it. We encourage folks to speak for themselves, to say, this is what I think, this is what I believe, this is what I want, or this is what I where I am. Because the next person then can come along and say, well, that's what you believe, and this is what I believe. You know, if somebody said, this is the way it is forevermore, then that person first has to knock down whatever it is forevermore before they can say what they believe. So that saves time if you try to speak for yourself. I'll be serving as the moderator, try to keep some order on it, keep somewhat focused, and promise you that at 10 o'clock I'll indicate that it is 10 and we'll pause, and those of you who are not terribly involved or not falling asleep and want to slip out, they surely may, and we'll continue as long as there's interest in keeping the conversation going. I'm going to try to keep as much as possible at the beginning to the speakers being alternated so those who haven't spoken yet get a chance to speak before the ones who have already spoken. Why the topic, whether there will be a slight change in the format tonight, and I'll say that in a moment. Why the topic, black-white frustration? A number of people have requested something about it. Some folks feel that we have forgotten and forsaken the minorities, blacks in particular. Some folks feel that inflation and energy are basically white middle-class issues. Considering that these has allowed or even caused black-white relations to further deteriorate. Some folks feel blacks are better off today than ever before. Some folks say feel that third world issues for America are centered primarily in New York, Detroit, Chicago, Washington, D.C., L.A., Dallas, Houston, and those places, maybe Seattle, and only then in Namibia, Nigeria, and South Africa. So there's a variety of reasons. Because we don't have, clearly and directly, a black voice tonight, and no one will be speaking for the blacks. Somebody might think they are or claim to be, but we are all whites here tonight, as far as I can tell. There may be some people who have a black background and all that, and they'll have to indicate that. So it's going to be a little tough to get that view in. We still may, have ideas about it. We've asked Ted Johnson to say a few words from his background experience, and my wife Ginny's going to say a couple words from her background experience related to this issue, and then we'll get into it. So that'll be brief, and I promise to keep them brief. And then we'll go into the discussion back and forth. You'll have a chance to respond either to them or, of course, to one another, because that's what it's about. Lead off, Ted. You want to give your background for saying this if you feel that's necessary. If you don't, that's all right, too.
In my work, I work in the school system as a social worker, and my job in the last 4 or 5 years particularly has been in a federal project which is dealing with human relations training for elementary school children, and particularly in racial integration kinds of situations. I work in a school where there are probably 50-50 as far as white, non-white, as far as the involvement in that school, not only black, but particularly Vietnamese, refugee, some Spanish-speaking families. The school I work at is in a project which in our area is considered the welfare island of our community in a sense. It's probably the only real neighborhood school in the whole Tacoma, Washington school area, in that 95% of our kids walk to school, which is not the case in other institutions and education throughout the city. I guess I come from this issue on that particular background. Black, white, or may I say majority-minority relations. Are they better now than they were? I think it's to be very obvious to say yes and no to that answer. We can start from there, and that hopefully doesn't stop everything just at the very beginning. Yes, I think we could say there's been certainly more exposure in our country and now in the world, there's certainly has been some symbolic growths as well as non-symbolic and real growth in the last 15 to 20 years in many, many areas, some economic, some social, some at least in the sense of contacts between more diversity in our society. And yet at the same time, it seems that we're in a lull period, in my estimation, as far as dealing with the subjects of minority-majority or intercultural relationships. And it's a concern of mine that I think we need to take a look at our models or our ideas about communication between diverse peoples. And we can start in our own local areas, because I think the same models and conceptions are applicable to worldwide and national kind of concerns. I think it's very easy to talk about the subject and talk either about international or national, not get local, or just the reverse. I think that's a key kind of area we need to be concerned. I was listening to some tapes this afternoon. I listened to one of John Schramm's sermons, and at the end of one of his sermons, he said, "What one of the thrusts we need to be involved with is, what does faithfulness to Jesus mean in this issue?" And I guess that's kind of what I throw out as our struggle for the evening. Let me just kind of, I don't intend to talk very long, kind of get some indications. I think we're in a general lull period, and have been, in the area of taking and looking seriously at multicultural, inter-ethnic communication relations. And particularly, I think I've been noticing this, particularly in the last year or two, in my own experience. And I guess in that regard, I can say things are getting worse. I think, from my experience, I think the last year particularly, the last 7-8 months particularly, I say I'm sensing words and content of discussions around me that I hadn't heard for a while. Some of the skeletons seem to be coming out of the closet, and I kind of think it may be possibly because all of us are feeling very insecure. All of us, meaning minority and majorities, are more insecure than ever before, particularly with the economics the way they are. And I give you some indicators. It really has been, to me, my mouth has dropped open when we see almost boldly and openly the KKK, Ku Klux Klan, getting footholds in areas, even in the state of Washington. And I shouldn't say this even, but we don't think we're part of the South, as where that all came from. And it sounds, there's some interesting and frightening kinds of ugly heads raising up again, and boldly. Articles in the Tacoma News Tribune, which did a whole big article, one whole full page a few months ago, on the Ku Klux Klan in the state of Washington. Boldly did, as an interview kind of thing. And not that it shouldn't be done, but it's out of the closet. Other kinds of things, Miami obviously must be on our minds. I think it's almost trite to say we have a volcano that did explode in a sense. I think I'm noticing the concern for justice and can you get it, the Miami situation, again raising that particular question. I suppose we thought we'd settle that in the 60s, in the early 70s, and I think that's part of a lull that's been involved here. Last night we talked about something, and it seems like at least one major political party is intentionally ignoring minorities, in at least in their official platforms. I think we spent a lot of time on that last night. I hope we don't get into that one tonight, but at least it's an indicator. You know, it's not politically relevant to bring that subject up, you know, up to the face. At least it wasn't as important as it was maybe 4 years ago. That's another indicator. And I think in all of this, I think we need to take a look at that. The concern, I say, for myself as a human being and a Christian human being, is that we struggle constantly with the concern to have dialogue or communication and linkages with our brothers and sisters, no matter who and where they are and what backgrounds they are. I'll say one more thing that really I'm noticing in my experience, limited as it might be, with minority people, is that I'm sensing a higher level of insecurity. Particularly among Black Americans that I relate with, in that I think as we've been talking here at Holden, and I've only been here for a couple of days now, about simpler lifestyles, the majority of minorities in this country are still trying to get on the bandwagon, at least psychologically and emotionally. Making a general statement here, are feeling they have not been a part of the American dream yet. They're climbing the hill, so to speak. And you know, I'll illustrate this from an experience I had with a colleague of mine in the Tacoma schools who was a psychologist. He happens to be a Native American, Indian American psychologist. We were in a conversation a while ago, and I made a profound statement in that, I kind of raised the question, well, maybe the values of American middle class thrusts aren't really worth going after. Why are you after that? And we had had a discussion around that. And she stopped me dead and she says, you have no right to tell that to me. I have got to make that decision myself. If you think as white, that's no longer part of your life, that's your business. But the majority of my people and around us are still trying to be a part of this dream. And what I'm going to say in conclusion is that there's a tremendous, I think, ambiguity that's occurring and more so among minority peoples who feel psychologically they have not made it because they've been after it for decades and longer than that, centuries to be a part of this country. And now it seems to be being taken away. And a question I ask is then, how do we minister or how do we deal with people like this living in sort of a dual society, caught in dual values? We're caught ourselves in them. And I think for minorities, I think it's more intense, i.e. the high rate of mental illness that occurs among minority populations, hypertension. The statistics kind of tell us that. The load that people are carrying and trying to make it and at the same breath deal with their own heritages and maintain some sense of meaning, I think, is very high. In that sense, the question is, where are we in common? And where are we not in common? And how can we identify and understand the common and the non-common this within all the groups? And I think that's true in our own individual families as well as it is in others. One last question. A fellow named Vine Deloria that I appreciate very much wrote a book, We Talk and You Listen. And I really kind of think that where I'm at is trying desperately to listen as a white American, to listen to where my brothers and sisters of other cultures are at this point. And it's very hard to listen right now in the midst of our anxiety to keep what we have, which is one of the great themes I think we're wrestling with right now.
Okay, thank you. Judy, credential?
Okay. First, I'd like to speak as a commissioner of the Madison Human Relations Commission. Madison is a town of 125 years age on the south side of Chicago. One that was settled by German Lutheran farmers, and the community stayed around under 3,000 until about 25 years ago. We moved there, and since then now, well, it was just in about the last 10 years that there has been the building of a large shopping center with about 120 stores that serves the whole southern area. And along with that, there are a lot of housing projects, and now Madison is a community with 15% minorities. The commission was brought into existence. We had an ordinance that Elmer and I worked on with about 10 people in the community 10 years ago, and there really wasn't any problem or any immediate problem that the trustees of the village had to deal with, and so nothing was done. The ordinance was never carried out, or rather in force. When we got about 15% minorities, people got to be very uneasy, thinking the property values would go down. The trustees were very uncomfortable, this is my interpretation, in handling that. So the ordinance was updated, and the commission, an official commission, was formed. There are seven of us on the commission, and our first task, and it has taken us about a year to gather all of the information, do all the groundwork, so that we really feel we know what we're doing, is enforcing a housing ordinance. Now, we have a local ordinance, even though there are federal ordinances and there are state ordinances. However, a local ordinance is enforced by the local community, which means that we become responsible. Two people in the community who have lived there for many years, who have some very fond, wonderful feelings of this small, charming little community, all this newness is very, very frightening. For many of the old-timers, they see our commission as being someone who is trying to move minority people in. The minority families that have come to the community may have a little bit of suspicion that we're trying to keep minorities from buying wherever they choose. We have had to work through the whole housing area, the whole housing problem in the community has been largely the operation of realtors in the community. And this has become so very, very subtle, those kind of operations where there is steering. And there are ways in which that can be tested. It's costly. It requires a lot of dedicated people. And even then, it's very, very difficult to get a case that will hold up in the court on racial steering. There are now computers used when people are looking for homes, so that it's difficult to get a test case where you have a minority and majority who both go asking for the same kind of a thing, so that you know whether they're both being shown the same kind of housing. We've found now that most of the minority families that come out are shown homes in all areas. However, it is often the realtor that is steering people who are white into only certain sections of the community. There is in our area, Park Forest, Park Forest South, two communities that have been the focus of national concern in testing housing ordinances, local housing ordinances. And there are several cases that are pending now. Very difficult. Park Forest South has had a fantastic program for housing. It's a well-integrated community. And then the National Realtors Association, I believe it is, that has something like 600,000 members, and they all belong to one association, that they combine their forces and in putting money into the cases that are local cases. I don't mean by that to say all realtors are unethical. However, there are unethical practices in real estate. And this is one of the things that we are trying to educate people in our community about. We have four Lutheran churches in this little small area. And some of the most difficult people to reach, to understand about how they could be supportive, are the people who are in our churches. One of the ways in which we can live out our commitment is by using the kind of influence where we have. We've got enough businessmen, people who are in places whereby they're sharing some words about how they would feel about this, could really be supportive, could really be helpful for carrying this out. And I only am spending a lot of time on this by saying, this is probably something that's happening very close to where you live. I think every community south of Chicago now is integrated with one or two families. I want to just define also the idea of when we talk about minorities. If we were talking about Holden Village and minorities, we might be thinking about anyone who is other than Swedish or German or Norwegian, and then we would be the other. So I think it's important to think about our frame of reference. We might think of people as minorities here who are non-Lutheran. In Madison, we talk about minorities, and when we do, we talk about those 15% that are non-white. I just want to say that I work downtown in Chicago, and the Chicago Public Schools now, who are going through many, many struggles, the Chicago Public Schools, the minorities are white. If we look at this in a global way, certainly those of us who are white are minorities. So I think we have to get a frame of reference, perhaps, that is different from one we may have had a number of years ago. A lot of other things I could say about that. I just want to then also say another area where I've had a bit of background and experience is through my work with the National Conference of Christians and Jews. I'm on the program staff. We've been around in Chicago for about 45 years. We're a human rights organization, and we work in the field of education, bringing people of all different kinds of backgrounds together to find dialogue and better understanding. Something I wanted to say about that. I do workshops on human relations skills, trying to help people within volunteer and nonprofit organizations where they don't have training programs to gain skills for working with one another. The real hopeful part of the very small job that I see I'm doing is that I have high diversity. I work to get those workshops with representation from people who are white, black, all kinds of Latino, Hispanic, American Indian, various people of different religious faiths. And it is in that kind of a workshop that we can really begin to hear one another. It isn't talking about somebody, it's talking with. I think sometimes that what we are even doing at NCCJ is so little. And I got a call from a woman who works with the Urban League in Chicago just before I came, and she wanted to stop by and get some materials. And she said something to me, "Well, you know, you are the training experts in the city. And I just want you to know how bad off Chicago is. Nobody's doing human relations skills training." It just seems that for a time there was a lot of that done. There is no conference on religion and race. There's no interreligious dialogue. Budgets are being cut. This is hitting the programs that affect the poor. The large number of minority people who are unemployed now is really frightening in and of itself, but now a lot of the people who have been stable in the communities, that have been holding those communities together, are the first ones losing jobs. Well, I've gone on quite a long time.
It's time for everybody else. You have freedom to react to what has been said or to enter into dialogue with yourself. I'll try to keep it close. Please.
Well, we felt in our community in Minnesota, we're considered part of the metropolitan area of Minneapolis and St. Paul. About a year and a half ago,
we all hear her.
About a year and a half ago, a number of synagogues in St. Paul were desecrated, and clergy and laymen both from all faiths came in droves to help clean up. And this was a hopeful sign, but we still have to listen that this is serious. You know, even one or two incidents, I think, are very serious. And even if it happened a year and a half ago, we still have to work to see that it doesn't happen again. And my girlfriend, who lives in Milwaukee, her daughter was thrown in jail when she marched in opposition to a Nazi party march that took place. And incidentally, the Nazi party is very active in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. She was thrown in jail, and the women and the blacks were beaten severely. And so that just happened a year ago.
Okay.
So these things are coming to a head, I think, or happening.
Someone else?
Question back here.
Oh, please, come on.
When you have a minority, what percentage of bloodline is classified as a minority in a person?
No idea.
0.25%?
I don't think that the census ever shows that. It might be that somebody next door said that was a minority and it got reported in that way. I don't believe there are any accurate.
Oh, I thought maybe you had some type of data.
I kind of think the minority really in our society is not a mathematical term, that we play with it that way. I think for me, minority means it's a power, it's dealing with power.
Well, no, if you're half Cuban, if you're half Cuban or if you're half Spanish, what? If you're 25% Spanish, what do you base it on?
Let me step out of my role as moderator. They didn't say what I thought ought to be said then. I think their blacks and whites are going to kill each other in America in the cities within the next 10 years. They're going to start shooting. All I'm saying, they ain't going to ask for quarter or half. They're going to aim, and black policemen will shoot white policemen with uniforms on. And white policemen will shoot black policemen with uniforms on. I think you take away the jobs and the prospect of hope, there's going to be killing in the streets. I don't think it's a few little uprisings. I think murder is coming. My university, it's worse, clearly worse, drastically worse than it was 10 years ago. People hate each other out loud, quote, better than they did 10 years ago. But I don't think it's a casual discussion. I'll go back to being moderate. Please.
Well, I think I would echo what you said, Elmer. In Portland right now, we're having a very terrible black-white school board fight. About 10 years ago, Portland took off on a desegregation plan because, I suppose in inner city Portland, what's the black population? 20%? Say 10-20% in the city. 15%. And most people would, in the education circle, said it was a noteworthy national program. Last year we had a one-day boycott of black school children, and it's estimated that about 90% of black school children in the school district, and this is a school district servicing a community of almost 400,000 people, approximately 90% of the black students did not go. So it had a lot of power. Just recently, the superintendent was fired because he wasn't moving in the right direction of desegregation. Well, he was the big power in implementing this desegregation program. Now there's a recall for the people that fired the superintendent. And the black population has a recall on the people that supported the superintendent. It's an institution, you know, a very stable institution, education. But it's the same thing we're talking about, only it's not in the streets, it's in schools. And it's a black-white issue, and it's really getting hot.
Yeah. I think so many white people I talk to seem to think, well, with affirmative action, blacks really have it made, and if they want a job, they can get it. And could you just comment on this, too? Is this a lot of illusion?
Or is there anybody, or you two want to comment?
No. I think there's a mass assault on from all kinds of, a mass assault on those programs alone right now. The great fear is going on, what has been gained is going to be lost. There's a great psychological fear going on in that respect, and some reality to that. I think Bakke and some of the other things are again examples of that. I get the feeling that I think some of those, in another year or two, are going to, and many communities are going to go. Pull them back. I get that feeling. There's a fear of that happening.
You're aware of the General Motors impact in Michigan. Saginaw is a community of 100,000 people proper, 40,000 black citizens, approximately 15,000 Hispanics. They have the least seniority in every job they have, whether it be General Motors or Sears or many other places. But the state, as Dorothy said, you may not be aware, but they are well supported for 1 year of layoff from General Motors Fund and from the federal government, and after that they will be on welfare. It does not look in Michigan like this situation will be solved in 1 year. We see in Saginaw a foreign car tires being slashed. I'm anticipating foreign cars being destroyed. Saginaw, though it has a small population, has one of the highest percentages of murder per capita, almost always black against black. I see almost always drug-related because I worked a lot in the drug community. And I see that that's not going to continue. You know, that they're going to start not killing themselves, they're going to start getting, they start getting smart. And it's a very explosive situation.
I think also a lot of the citizens in Chicago are armed, private citizens, both black and white.
What?
Armed.
My wife has a story about a gentleman who attended one of her workshops. Well,
I don't know if any of you are familiar with Robert Taylor Homes or Cabrini Green. They're very large housing where there are thousands of people in one building, 20 stories high, and there are two elevators. And one of the young men who was working as a supervisor had come to the second workshop and he had said something about, well, I'm just glad to be here alive today. And when I talked to him at noon, he said, well, there was a shootout in the elevator in my building. And he was coming down. I said, well, my gosh, what was that about? And he said, well, a woman was in the elevator when I got on, and we stopped the next floor. Another man got on. He said hello. She didn't answer. He got mad. She pulled out a gun. He pulled out a gun. The bullets were ricocheting. I ducked, and I'm safe. And I said, well, then what happened? He says, oh, they just both got off the elevator and walked away. Police in Chicago will not go into the housing projects because there's two elevators. They're absolutely, whether they're black or white, they are targets. A lot of snipers. And I don't mean this to sound like it's a jungle. I'm just, the thing that I guess is so hard for me is that there are many people who live there who have no alternative. The people who live there, most are not pleased about that. They have no other place to go.
Do you think they're helping themselves enough? I've had occasions where I've had openings, asked other blacks to refer another black. They said, no way. I've even gone to the USES and called black people, supervisors there, to send over blacks. They didn't send blacks over. So are they doing enough for themselves? I don't say it racially because my son has adopted a black boy, but I wonder at times if they are helping themselves.
Anybody got a response to that?
Well, I think there are cases where they are not. I have a customer, or I did have a customer a few years ago, who was a cement finishing contractor. He was black. And I was surprised after I'd known him for 4 or 5 years, done some business with him, several levels, to find out that he had only two other blacks in his cement finishing crew working on a job that had 14, 15 people. One of them was his son, and one of them was his son's school. I had gone to school with his son. And I said, so I'm surprised that you don't raise, I don't have more blacks working for you. And he says, I can't find any more good blacks. The rest of his employers, there was one Spanish surname one, and the rest of them were Swedes and Englishmen and so on, the background.
What else? Yeah.
I'd just like to make a comment in terms of the business end. I happen to be a pastor. I serve a congregation that's at least 60% black. My experience in the church has been that every time I have gone to any facet of the church that is building a program, building buildings, mm-hmm. I have never been able to get any kind of definite statement from any of those people that they will try, that they will indeed hire blacks, that they will go out of their way to, you know, we're in bad economic times. If I were running a painting business they told me that if I was going to get a contract, I needed to affirm the beliefs of the church in terms of fair hiring practices, I would have some blacks on that my crew. I have never seen yet the church, at least in my experience, make that kind of elementary request. of any contractor. And that to me is just one simple way in which I think the church, we as Christians, have let down the minority communities. I have yet to see a black secretary in any Lutheran church except in Cabrini Green, you know, Holy Family, or some dire inner city church. I have yet to see any attempts to hire blacks in our churches. You know, that's part of the frustration. I think it just shows, I guess, maybe it's my side of saying that indeed maybe there are blacks who don't do enough, but I can't help but believe personally that the whites have done exceedingly little, and we as white Christians have done almost so little that I think that to find fault with the few black people who are trying to survive in our society is just, it blows my mind and brings on great frustration when I hear that.
Well, I think, I've been sitting here just thinking about a lot of this, because I came in here thinking that the black people have a chip on their shoulder and that you got to sell yourself to them. And then as I think and listen, the thought comes to me that I think that the black population especially is so well aware that we don't hire them unless we have to. That they are smart. And so they're saying to this white community, if that's the way you want to treat us, honky, then stick it. We'll get you for everything we'll get you for. And as long as everybody in the room feels that the only reason that you're going to have to relationships with a black person as long is because you have to, whether you're an employer or as a human being, then you're going to get that chip on your shoulder effect, and you're going to get that feeling that they're not doing much for themselves. It's a token. It's a token. Watch your TV ads. Watch anything. We treat them as tokens. They're employed only because we have to employ them. Have you met your affirmative action plan? I work with handicapped people, and it's the same thing there, you know? But we're not talking about handicapped people.
Yes, please.
Yeah, the comment that we hire them because we have to. Now, from my perspective, I deal a lot with the business. 10 years ago, the business community in my locality understood that we had to. And a lot of effort was made to accomplish just that, to do a job in trying to hire these people and make room for them. I keenly feel that now the pressure is off and that we are no longer really trying to hire. And not only that, I hear it over and over again, the jokes that we're making no effort really to put these people to work. I think we've gone backwards. I think it's going to happen within the last couple of years is the clearest in my mind. And the rhetoric I hear around this country right now is we're taking a massive step backwards right now.
Someone else?
The story I told about the cement finishes is a sort of a vignette. I think within the community I am, and I work in downtown Seattle, I'm handling some work in connection with a high-rise office building. There are a number of blacks, steel workers, some other trades. Not all of them are full journeymen, many of them are assistants that are sort of apprentices, although not always on the formal apprenticeship program, former laborers. I worked for a company that accepted the fact that we had to hire minorities, not just blacks, quite a few years ago. I don't know just when I became aware of it. When I moved to Seattle, I moved into a building. I'm still in that building. It's a half a block building. It's 5 stories. It was our headquarters building. It no longer is, but it's all our people. There were 2 blacks working there. One of them is the assistant to the supply man. The other wore a uniform and a gun. they're both still there. The man that was assistant to supply officer has a junior officer capacity. The man that wore the gun is in charge of our security forces at this time. We have a number of blacks who are in the junior officer's status. We have quite a few Orientals. We've done a much better job with Oriental than we have anywhere else. Our poorest record is with the American Indian, and it's the effort that we have tried the most diligently to fill. And, you know, this office of equal opportunity, it's a no quota quota. Nobody will ever exactly tell you you've got a quota, but you know you have. And the company has been, with the exception of the American Indian deal, ahead of the quota, which meant they've had the luxury when they've got a minority who doesn't do well, who's on for a free ride, and there are those, to fire them. And this is wonderful, because if you can fire one, if you're doing well enough that you can fire one, you're at least doing reasonably well, but it has a salutary effect on these people who might become free riders too. And a lot of these are young people. Their work habits, it doesn't make a difference whether they're white or black or whatever, their work habits are not fully formed. And if you get a bunch of young blacks in a deal, or young anybody in a deal, who think you can't fire them, you're not going to get their best efforts unless they are the unusual person. So we've not got many blacks into the middle or upper management group, but we just awful lot of minorities in our building. I mean, I don't know what our percentages are. We don't report on them, but we've got a lot of them, and we've got some very good ones. So I'm amazed how good ones we do have.
Somebody else?
Thanks,
Larry.
I think there's a factor of class that is entering in with greater significance and power than it did 10 years ago. And as Americans, we could avoid a lot of the problems of traditionally associated with class conflict because we had an expanding economy where even if you said, the rich got richer and we're still the same distance from the poor were often moving up, and there was that kind of upward mobility even though the gap was there. And we went to a solution of our social problems by way of the results of an expanding economy. So the war on poverty under Lyndon Johnson was launched. Not by the redistribution of wealth, but by the increase of it. And what frightens me now is that I think that our basic strategy for handling those tensions and those problems is one that the economy no longer supports. And the neighborhood that we live in is predominantly black. And I see both in the white community and in the black community the effects of class. Because a number of the folks who live in our neighborhood are of incomes like Nyla and myself. That is to say, they are middle class blacks who a generation ago were not. And now they have a real stake in maintaining that. They've arrived. And there's a real split within the black community itself. Because, in fact, there was a move into the middle class by some, where at the same time that there was an increase in the number of poor blacks, a lot of them in Washington have come up from the rural Carolinas and rural Virginias to the city looking for jobs and so on. And to me, it's bleak. Because of this factor of class with affecting both white and black communities. The other thing to add to that is that I think there's a whole set of American cities that are just at the verge of serious problems. Some place like New York is going to get federal aid because we can't let New York go under. It's a financial city, it's a world city, etc. But the Toledos, where a lot of a higher percentage of minority population than some other places, those cities suffer the loss of revenue that the economy president. I think it's a volatile situation.
Thank you. Someone else?
Yes,
I... Yes, oh, please, come on.
I think if you're going to get at the root of the problem, I think you're going to have to personally know them. It's just like if you're working at a mill, and if you know of an opening, you're going to tell your neighbor that, hey, there's an opening at Reynolds Aluminum. Why don't you go down and put your application in? And it's the same thing with a black. If you personally know him, and you live in the same community as what this gentleman is saying, like he's living within a, 40% black? 65% black. He could go home and say, well, John Doe, there's an opening down here at Reynolds Aluminum. Why don't you put your application in? This way they don't feel like they're being hired as a minority. You're being a friend and a neighbor by saying there is an opening. Does that make sense?
Really?
One of the things I see looming as another ugly head on this thing is the whole issue of zoning laws. I'm thinking about my community. I live in Tacoma, the area that is somewhat been over the years accessible and is accessible to low-income peoples. There is now underfoot a movement to bring in high-rise apartments and high-cost, you know, middle and upper-middle-class people into that thrust. And I'm hearing some community leaders talk about, you know, the flirtation with zoning laws. That the issue comes out to be, you know, we real estate wise don't live with one another in this country. My own self history, I never lived with a non-white person until I literally moved to a setting like maybe Washington D.C. I didn't live there, but it was in California. You know, I think that's really an issue we better start addressing, because I see some subtle and not so subtle things starting to happen with such things as zoning laws, so that even areas that are multiracial are going to be, you know, that we moved from generally out to the suburbs, so people are going to be coming back in, okay? And I guess the issue is we've got to start dealing with the political nitty-gritty of zoning laws and related kinds of things with real estate. We really haven't addressed that much, you know, as Christians in a political sense. We flirted with them in different areas.
Well, we've been doing that for years. And so we don't have a neighbor anymore, because you can't be a neighbor to somebody who's 10 floors up. And I mean, this has been going on for a long time.
Sure.
They've been destroying neighborhoods. So that you have to go miles to be a neighbor to a black person, because they no longer live next door to you.
Yes, please.
I'm interested in pursuing the idea of something that can be hopeful and positive, and I like the idea that you mentioned about human relations workshops, because I think the experience I'm thinking about is, in our churches, we were not in a position of wanting to make... I'm not a Lutheran. I'm a member of the Christian Church, Disciples of Christ. And we, too, are mostly white. And when we began to be aware of the black-white issue, we really wanted to make some reconciliation and not be separate. So immediately we tried to work with our young people. We thought in our summer conferences this would be good to make a contact with young people, because they have their life ahead and maybe they're not as set in their ways. So immediately we invited black people to our summer youth conference. There were some violent confrontations, and because we were not trained in handling these kinds of antagonisms and angers and violence, people were afraid of it, and so although there was a willingness to try and to reach out and say, we want to do better than we have, when things were unhandleable, people just backed up and said, I made a mistake, I don't know what to do, and so we backed out of it, or have been less effective than we should have been. And so I see that there's a great need for the training to know how to handle conflict, what to do when people don't know how to relate to one another, and that sort of thing. Can you say more about...
Well, I don't think there are any easy answers in that. Some things are so far along the way. I wish there were someone black here to give you a response of having been a person who may have been brought in order to kind of give those people who are white some kind of a racial experience. Even in those things, sometimes it's like it's almost a using of people. Now, I don't know whether that's yours or not. I just want to say, if you're a Methodist, I don't know if this would be of interest to you, but I do think that we should all know about the work of the Lutheran Human Relations Association, which can bring workshops into communities. You know, they're trying to set up a network around the country so that congregations can be helped in bringing some of these issues and skills.
I'd be unfaithful if I didn't step out of the moderator role to say something about that. I've been a consultant to the Lutheran Human Relations for about 20 years, to their board of directors, and I would affirm their availability almost all over the country to provide the kind of leadership training and skills training that you have, and that you were talking about. They're building a network. I think they have something like 150 trained people spotted around the country at this moment who, within not too distant, could put together workshops of that kind and other kinds of resources, too. It's Lutheran Human Relations Association of America. They're located at Valparaiso University in Valparaiso, Indiana. They are an inter-Lutheran operation. They are not controlled by the church, but they are affirmed by the church, ALC, LCA, Missouri Synod, and AELC. I think it's a good outfit. It's got good things to offer.
And I would even say, if any of you will give me your names, I'll see that you're put on the mailing list for their newspaper, and that will give you some kind of a notion of some of the things that are offered. Also, if there are people here who have skills in doing workshops and would like to be part of teams that will work in communities, I know that that's underway. I plan to be part of a team that would be doing workshops, and so trying to gather the resources.
There and there.
I'd like to compliment the church for their effort. So often, and also your particular effort, I think we all have to start someplace, and we have some failures, and we have to pick ourselves up and dust ourselves off and start again. That holds true in the business world, which I'm in, and bringing in some blacks that have disappointed me in terms of the result. I had to deal with it, and it was not easy. In fact, it was very, very difficult. But that didn't discourage us from going ahead, and we've had some successes as a result of that. So I just say that all of you who haven't tried, start someplace. And then when you lose and find that, oh gosh, I give my effort, and I guess that takes care of that, think about it again and start over.
Sir.
Well, you touched on one point of integration of neighborhoods and the zoning laws and so forth. I'd like to say something that may help to illustrate or illuminate the problem without suggesting a solution, because I don't see any solution, frankly. And that is simply this, that in communities, particularly suburban communities where most people own their own homes, that is where neighborhoods just don't get integrated for long, long periods of time, if ever. And the reason is simply that when they do start to get integrated, an all-white community starts to get families of minorities moving in, the property values start going down. And it happens that homeowners, most of them, have all of their life savings, a good part of it anyway, and sometimes a good deal more than their total life savings tied up in their home. Their neighborhood is more or less uniform. They know their neighbors. When they go to sell their home, the one thing they don't want to do is to damage their neighbors' fortunes by driving the property values down. They hate terribly to do anything that would injure their neighbors. They don't want to make it a community that their former neighbors would be worse off with. This is something that, for which there may be a solution, but it certainly is not easy to see.
Okay, we're trying to deal with that in our community.
I'd like very
and
much
very often we look at it as being a problem because black people are moving in. There ain't going to be no place for them to move in if white people don't run out. In other words, if people will stay where they are and not sell through panic peddling, there are not going to be places where that community can change over. I mean, both the blacks and the white are being used for gaining money. Also, in the communities, some of the communities in the South End, Park Forest, 30,000 families with about, what percentage would you say a minority population?
It's 22, 24.
The property values have continued to go up. That community began as a planned community where at the very beginning they dealt with some of the things that could happen. And instead of waiting until there was a problem, they really did some community education. The mayor of Park Forest went, met with his board, and when the first black family moved into Park Forest, they personally went to the doors and called on all the people in the two-block area, gave them some information about the family, because it's when there are rumors and no real information that rumors can create fantastic fright, fear, panic. And all those things are really manageable if people will take responsibility for not being part of that group that panics and passes rumors. Find ways in which you can have a clearinghouse, rafts of things that I think we can do as people living in a community when it becomes integrated.
And the church is a resource, the church as an institution, as a resource at that particular moment of, you know, of decision and transfer, change and transition. It seems to be such a crucial point. If the church becomes the hallmark of those who are doing not only the sensible thing, but Christian thing, pretty amazing. Yeah.
I still have great qualms, and I hope this isn't too judgmental, about the role of the church in this whole area. All too often, I think the church is also chosen to run, not just property owners, but the church has also said, let's move. The neighborhood is not the same as it should be. And maybe because we live in America and success is tied up with money and numbers, churches in low-income areas, especially, I think, in interracial areas, who cannot pay their own way, are put on subsidy sometimes. And that is a very questionable thing. It's like being on a federal program that you don't know if the funding is going to go through. You know, how long can you expect to live on subsidy? And yet, is the gospel only for those who can pay? Or is the gospel for all people? If the churches that are in interracial neighborhoods would close, how welcome would their minority members be in other churches? And I guess another thing that bothers me a little bit, and I, again, this is a judgment on my part, and it's only my judgment, many white Lutheran churches have been all too happy to accept as transfers those who have chosen to move out because blacks have come into their other church. That bothers me because I don't think there's been any repentance or maybe even dealing with that whole idea, why am I leaving the church I was? And I realize the great American dream is that you can choose anything you want to, but I think we've let cheap grace come in, as Dietrich Bonhoeffer used the term, in a sense that if it's easier somewhere else, let's move on. And I worry about us as a church and as Christian committed people. Are we doing what we can to keep the gospel for everybody? Or are we harboring our very Norwegian, German, and Swedish ideas in the American Lutheran Church or whatever Lutheran church we belong to? Is it open to everybody?
Someone respond?
Thank you. After the question, has anyone had any experience in integrating Christians of minorities whose style of worship is quite different than your own established congregation?
Can I just say to that, Marty Wold, who some of you know in the ALC, who works with churches that are integrating, said that possibly the most unfortunate thing that has happened to us as Lutherans is the fact that we came from countries where we spoke languages. When we came to this country, that we stayed together with the people who spoke the same language, so that we have really developed a whole culture of our liturgy and our hymns and our music that is so tied to that native tongue that we had, that it is possibly our biggest drawback as churches today.
How would a Lutheran church integrate blacks of a Baptist style?
jump out of there.
No idea.
For an answer that Bishop Chilstrom gave in Pennsylvania, he said there was a massive, marvelous center city transfer of that in which the blacks came and enjoyed and were led into, you know, were a long period of time of education into the Lutheran tradition of worship and are celebrating it now 20, 30, or I don't know how many years later, and a very active kind of congregation working in that city. He illustrated one place, or I don't know if there's more than that.
That might be more conversion than immigration.
Maybe.
I think really the answer to that is very various in terms of that there are congregations of the Lutheran denomination who adopt all kinds of methodologies and forms. And I guess my own perception is it's not so much the method, although I think it's a misconception to believe that blacks are of certain mindset. They have been culturally brought up in a context, but you can find black congregations that are as high churches as anything. You know, so if they were brought up Baptist, obviously that, you know, just like we were brought up Lutheran, you know Almighty Fortress. If you were brought up, you know, Baptist, you know Amazing Grace.
The Baptist churches out in our area don't have any more black members than the Lutheran churches.
But I guess...
So, I'm saying, I don't think it is only having the same...
I think, the basic building blocks are, is the church friendly? Does it really want people, no matter who they are, there? You know, is it a clique, or does it really welcome people? Is it going to minister to these people's needs? If those answers are true, then I think it won't matter if you use the LBW or if you have a very informal folk service. I think they will come if people of any persuasion feel welcome. Nobody goes to a church where he feels completely ostracized.
You had a hand before.
We have a very neat thing going in Saginaw. St. John's, of which I am a member, 800 families approximately members of St. John's, is in the east side of Saginaw. The east side of Saginaw is black. The river divides the city. And poor whites and blacks live on the east side of Saginaw. St. John's is on the near east side. 3 years ago, St. John's is ALC, American Lutheran Church, for those who are not Lutheran. 3 years ago, a Missouri Synod church further into the black community, in the center of the black community, could no longer support themselves, so a very unique thing happened. The ALC and the Missouri Synod entered into an arrangement whereby we call the pastor and pay part of his salary, and the Missouri Synod pays part of his salary, and services of an ALC nature are held in the church on Cherry Street, which is Trinity. They also had a Missouri Synod school, which no longer could function because they couldn't afford it. And so what's happening now is the population of the Missouri Synod Church, Trinity, is very, very old. I imagine the average membership there must be over 60. If you go there to church, you see very, very few young people. So it's obvious, that it's not going to be too long, and that is not going to be, there is not going to be any white population going to church there. In the meantime, we are providing athletic events, we are providing movies, we are providing all kinds of activities along that line in the Trinity Center for the people of the neighborhood. And I can speculate that St. John's is not going to become racially integrated for a long time because it's a very racist congregation as I see it. But Trinity Center is. And it could become a Lutheran black church in 5 to 8 years when these young people become not 13 to 15, but to become 21 to 25. They have good feelings about Trinity Center and Trinity Church. That's one example that I cite as a, in response.